Today's reading is from 1 Samuel. Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, was lying down in his room. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was. Then the Lord called, "Samuel, Samuel!" And he said, "Here I am," and ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call. Lie down again." So he went and lay down. The Lord called again, "Samuel." Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call, my son. Lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. The Lord called Samuel again a third time, and he got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." Then Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down. And if he calls you, you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Now the Lord came and stood there, calling as before, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant is listening." Then the Lord said to Samuel, "See, I'm about to do something." The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
It's kind of tough to start the service with a clip from Blues Brothers because, you know, when you see James Brown up there preaching, I feel like that sets the bar pretty high for what's going to happen in the service. I said to Jamelyn, I said, you know, we needed at least a stunt double who could do the flips coming down the aisle and flip up here on stage and then turn around and it's just us. Today I'm going to be talking about call, as Jamelyn said, and I'm just going to put some quotes on the screen behind me as a way of kind of organizing my message around different quotes and stories. That this first preach is not really a direct quote per se, but more of a story that I received over the years. Many of you know that my dad was a Methodist pastor. And many of you also know that my dad passed away when I was pretty young. And when my dad passed away, our family moved from Murray, Kentucky, which was where the church that he was serving at the time was located, back to my hometown where both my mom and my dad had grown up. So I grew up going to the same church that my dad had grown up going to, sitting in the same pew with my grandmother that he'd sat in over the years. And so I was the recipient of all these stories from people in that church and in the town about what kind of man and minister he was. And one of those stories had to do with his call. The story goes, it was the summer between his sophomore and junior years in college. And he was going to Vanderbilt College. He was on a naval ROTC scholarship. And so he knew what the next immediate future looked like, you know, the next 4 years of his life. But it was in that stage of his college his collegiate career, where he had to kind of declare a major and set a course. And he, at that time, was very confused about what he was called to do and not really sure. You know, I don't even think he used the language of call, perhaps. I mean, it's just he didn't know what to do with his life. And so one Sunday he was home, and you have to kind of picture this a little bit, that our sanctuary, there was a beautiful wooden altar at the front, a railing that went all the way across, and we used the altar not for altar calls per se, but for communion every month. When it was our time, you know, every first Sunday of every month when we were taking communion, people would come forward, two or three or four pews at a time, and line up and kneel at that wooden railing, and the pastor would go along and serve the bread and the juice and then say a benediction and a prayer, and they'd all go back to their seats, and the next few pews would come in. And so that was kind of the context that my dad came forward for communion one Sunday. And it was just on his heart, you know, this confusion about his life and what is he supposed to do. And he prayed, "God, tell me what I'm supposed to do." Not out loud, but kind of in his heart. And he heard an audible voice that said, "Preach." And there his course was set. Now, I've never had the chance to verify that story, to know if that's exactly how it happened. That's just the story I received. And you can imagine what it's like for a young boy growing up in that same church, going once a month to that same altar rail where my dad received his call to receive communion, the impression that it would have made on me over the years. And I always linked it in my head to the story of Samuel and Eli. That this idea, this that God speaks, that God calls, that when we don't know what to do with our lives, when we aren't sure, that God speaks into that directly to us. It's a powerful story. And I've always believed my whole life long that God speaks. There's been times when I feel like God has spoken to me, but I have not been the beneficiary, like Samuel or like my dad, of an audible voice. And so the question, I think, you know, yes, God speaks, but if God doesn't speak in that way, is anything less than a direct message to us, is anything less than that a calling? Can we be called if we've never heard the audible voice of God? I've been helped with books that I've read over the years. One of them is this little small book called The Minister as Diagnostician. Not exactly the most gripping title, but it's so helpful to me. I was given it when I was a chaplain, right after seminary, working as a chaplain in a hospital. And let me just describe the context of that. I felt perfectly comfortable kind of going into people's rooms and talking with them and praying with them. I knew what I was doing in those settings. The places that were most difficult for me as a chaplain or when I was participating in rounds, when I was sitting around a table with doctors and nurses and physical therapists and social workers and psychologists who all had very technical language, and they were all doing very specific interventions in the life of each patient. And they would talk about the criteria that they were using. I mean, it was so tangible what they were doing and how they were helping. And then it would get to me, and they'd say, "Do you have anything to add?" And I'd be like, "Well, we prayed together," which felt so kind of whispery and insubstantial. I mean, how was I contributing to the overall health of each person? And this book kind of came as a gift to me in that place because Martin Prizer, he kind of describes different criteria that pastors could use. And instead of kind of using borrowing medical jargon, like talking about someone being depressed, which is actually a clinical term, he says, instead of doing that, use your theological language. Like when you're talking with someone, be listening for, do they have hope? And what's the nature of their hope? And what are they hoping for? And where does their hope come from? and be listening for trust and faith. Do they believe and trust in God's providence and care? And be listening for the health of their relationships, for grace. Do they give and receive forgiveness? Are they capable of saying, "I'm sorry"? Are they capable of letting regrets go? And so anyways, he has all these criteria for us to listen to as pastors. But the last one he lists is the variable of vocation. And he says this one is perhaps most important of all. Now, vocation, we often boil down to the question of job, work. What's your vocation? What do you do for a living? How do you earn your money? But that's not what vocation means. The Latin root of the word vocation is call. And so if I'm a pastor trying to get a sense of your vocation, I wouldn't ask, "So tell me what you do for a living." Because you could answer that question and I'd still have no sense of whether you actually experience or have a sense of vocation. Instead, what I'd be listening for is whether you have a sense of meaning, purpose, significance in your life. And it's not just about the work you do. It's really an orientation to a whole of life. As Prizer puts it, vocation is putting one's talents to work as a cheerful participant. I love that, cheerful participant. And the process that moves the universe toward increasing integrity and wholeness. Now, he unpacks that over a course of a whole chapter. But my layman's translation of that is, do you have a sense that your life is given to something bigger than yourself? That's vocation. And having that sense that your life is given to something bigger than yourself, it is incredibly transforming because then any task acquires new meaning. Adam Grant, in his book, Give and Take, he gives examples of the motivational power of purpose. And one of my favorite examples he gives is a social experiment that he did on the college campus. He is a professor at Wheaton College, and he said he did this little social experiment. There was a group of students whose job it was to call alumni, you know, and to ask them for money for a certain scholarship, very similar to what David Heaton did just a moment ago, except these were college students who were not paid professionals, not fundraisers, and they were just given a list of names, and they'd call them at random, and they had a script that they were supposed to follow through. He says, you know, this, if you were to take surveys of all the jobs that college students have to do, this one is one of the least liked, because, I mean, it's how easy is it to call a complete stranger and ask them for money? He said, so could motivation transform that experience? So he took this group of students and he broke them into three groups, three subgroups. The first group was the control group. He didn't do anything with them. They just followed the script, made their calls, you know, what the results they got were the results they got. The middle group, he thought, okay, let's try to motivate them through personal purpose and benefits. So before they made their calls, they did a little bit of education, made a presentation about the money that they were going to personally make through this process, and also the skills that they were going to develop, that they were going to develop skills of networking and salesmanship, right? The third group, they said, let's not focus on personal benefits, let's focus on societal benefits. So they gave them stories of people who are going to receive the scholarships. So which would prove most motivational, the personal motivation or serving a societal purpose? Well, after the experiment was done, he said there was virtually no difference between groups A and B. The group B performed just about the same as group A did. But group C, that had read stories about the scholarship participants, their productivity increased by 155%. These groups, on average, got 9 pledges per week. That group got 23 pledges per week, per person per week. That's how powerful it was. And then Adam Grant said, well, I wanted to see, can we push it even further? If just reading stories about scholarship recipients had that kind of influence, what if you met a scholarship student? What if you had 5 minutes to ask them questions about their life and about their impact that this scholarship had? And so he set up this experiment for another group to interview a scholarship recipient for 5 minutes. He says their productivity went up by 400%. It's amazing what happens to any task, any job, when we just have the sense that it's not just serving us, but serving something bigger than us. I've been reading a book called Work Rules by Laszlo Bock. Laszlo Bock is the senior vice president of people operations at Google. People operations, I think, is their jargon for human resources, but they call it something different. And Google, if you don't know, is one of the, you know, consistently rated one of the best places to work in the country. I picked up this book because Laszlo is one of the speakers at the Global Leadership Summit. And I thought, you know, I always want to kind of read some of the books to know who the speakers are going to be. And I didn't know this guy, so I picked up the book. And Google is fascinating. I mean, not just the work they do and the products they develop, but just the culture of the place. If you've ever seen the movie The Internship, it's an old movie with Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn. You know, they kind of talk about the quirkiness of the Google culture that they create, you know, recreation as part of it, and they provide meals, like gourmet meals, for all their employees. And he says, but Laszlo Bock says, you know, people think that's the essence of the culture. It's not. Our culture as a company is built on three pillars: mission, transparency, and voice. And of those three, the most important is mission. He says, whenever we do our annual surveys on employee satisfaction, whenever we see a group or people whose their satisfaction is going down, 9 times out of 10, it's because they've lost a sense of connection with the mission that they're trying to serve. They're not connected to the people, the users, receiving our products. And so they try to rebuild that connection. He says, you know, this is he says, people see their work as either a job, which is just a necessity, a career, as something they have to advance in. It's kind of a competitive thing, or as a calling, a source of enjoyment and fulfillment that you're doing socially useful work. And he says, we want to take every single job, no matter what it is, and make it more of a calling and less of a job. The example he gives is of a man who works in their bagel shop that serves their employees. And this man, his job is to be a fish slicer. He takes lox, you know, dry, you know, cured salmon, and he slices it all day long to go on bagels to feed the employees. And he says, this man, his background is very interesting because he's from Tibet. And he used to be a Sherpa. He used to be one of those people who helped people from Western countries get to the top of Mount Everest. And so he interviewed him, and he said, you know, compared to the work you once had, which had to be exciting and thrilling and fulfilling, this beautiful, you know, Mount Everest, and now you're slicing fish. And the man said this. He said, you know, I look at it as the same. I'm just helping people get what they need. And just that simple framework of helping other people is enough to drive up his satisfaction. It reminded me of another story I heard of. This is about hospital work. And there was this particular hospital that was doing study of morale in their employees. And there was one particular area that they diagnosed as having exceedingly low morale. The job was the washing and putting together kits of surgical instruments. He says the work was tedious, monotonous, repetitive, again and again and again, and it was so far disconnected from patient care. It took place down in the bowels of the hospital, and it was so crucially important because, you know, you think about surgery, and if they aren't doing that job carefully, what could go wrong? And yet the turnover rate at this particular hospital was so high, except there was one person who stuck with it. In fact, she'd been doing this job for over 15 years. And they wanted to find out what's the secret for her, because then maybe we can get other people to do the same thing. And they observed her, and they noticed that while she did the work, she sang. But she didn't sing pop music or anything like that. She sang hymns and spiritual songs. And they interviewed her and said, you know, what are you thinking about while you work? And she said, well, I'm not necessarily thinking. I'm just praying. I don't know who's going to, you know, be the recipient of the work that I'm doing. I don't know who's going to go under the knives that I'm cleaning and packing, but I pray for each and every person. And just that simple act of praying is enough to take it from being a job to being a calling. My point is that you don't have to be a preacher. You don't have to stand in front of a congregation to be called. God calls all of us in so many myriad ways to be part of his work of making the world whole again. The question is whether or not we sense what we're doing is part of that call. Because the reality is, if there's any way that you can be called, if anything can be a calling, then it kind of opens it wide open. The question becomes, how do I know if I'm called? What is my calling? Dan Webster, gives this example of a grand piano. We have one sitting over there in the shadows. And he said, if you were to lift up the top of a grand piano, you would see 88 strings stretched out to different lengths and tonalities. And if you were to scream into the piano, ah, which that's a way of waking anyone up who's fallen asleep. But if you were to scream into the piano, there would be one string that would vibrate because it would resonate with the tone of your voice. And he says it's the same way that, you know, when we encounter a certain work or a project or a task, there are certain things that resonate with us, that wake us up inside. And what wakes me up inside may not be what wakes up you inside. And I love that illustration, but I also sometimes struggle with it because I realize there's not just a single voice coming at each of us. There's a whole bunch of voices. There's a whole bunch of noise coming at us. And in that confusion, there may not be one string that comes to life. It may be a whole bunch of them, or it may be nothing. They're all deadened. And it's not just young people trying to figure out their career that wrestle with this. I think more it's people who've jumped into a vocation, a calling, a career, and as they get further into it, they realize that it wasn't what they expected or thought it would be, that there's drudgery or there's politics or there's tension at the workplace, and it deadens the strings that used to vibrate. And then they wonder, did I choose the wrong thing? If I choose a different task in that place or over there, will something come back alive in me? I can tell you three times in my 7 years at St. Luke's, I feel like I've gone through a stretch of wrestling with my call, of trying to figure out what is it that I am called to do, made to do, created to do, and am I doing that? And whenever you enter into that place where it is confusing, that's where Eli's come in handy. Because the reality is God puts people in each of our lives to help us sort through the noise, to help us hear with greater clarity, to recognize God's voice, and to know how to respond to it. In my own call, I certainly needed that. Now remember, I grew up with this story of an audible voice that was crystal clear, that was beyond the shadow of a doubt, preach. And so I thought when I was called to ministry, I needed something like that. Now, I started to wrestle with my call the summer between my freshman and sophomore year of college. During that summer, I went and worked at a mission camp, similar to what we send our youth to, where we worked all summer long in the Appalachian Mountains, and youth groups would come to us, and we'd send them out in the community to do home repair work, to fix porches or to fix roofs or to paint homes, whatever was needed. And then they'd come back to the camp, and we'd have worship services and stuff in the evening for them to reflect on their work. And my job that summer wasn't to be a project manager, because my construction skills are, about zero. But my job during the summer was to go out and be the advanced scout, to go into the community and meet with people and see what their needs were and to build relationships with them. And then the teens would come in and do the work, and then I'd follow up afterwards to see what the experience was like. And then in the evenings, my job was to lead the programming, the worship services, and I tell you, I loved it. It was my first taste of full-time ministry, and I felt alive all summer long. This is another quote, which I didn't put on the screen, but I thought of it afterwards, but it goes like this: don't ask yourself, what does the world need? Instead, ask yourself, what makes you come alive? Because what the world needs is people who are fully alive. I didn't know that quote my sophomore year of college. Instead, I just knew that I wanted to do ministry, but I hadn't yet received an audible voice from God saying, preach or anything like that. And so I thought, in all my wisdom as an 18, 19-year-old, I thought, well, I'm just going to fast until I hear from God. I literally did this. I did not eat, and I don't know for how long. It wasn't that long, I promise, because eventually I realized if I hear a voice, it's going to be McDonald's, and that's probably not going to be my colleague. So I gave it up, but I was really confused. I mean, I was really lost with this, and that's why I'm thankful for Eli's, like my high school youth pastor, who consistently had given me opportunities to lead even before I knew I had gifts in that way, because he saw a potential in me that I didn't know. I think about my college chaplain, a man named Rob Spock, he was a gentle soul, and he had this way of asking probing questions without making you feel like you were being probed. And I remember spending an hour in his office before I went to seminary of him grilling me, and except I didn't feel like I was being grilled. And at the end, he said, Dave, for the last hour, I've been playing devil's advocate, and I tell you, you're just ready. I think about a man named Barry St. Clair, who I only met once, and he was totally influential in my life. Our youth group used to go to this Christmas conference, Christmas Challenge was what it's called. It was the 27th through the 30th, the week after Christmas, when kids are just sitting at home, and we used to go to this conference, our youth group did, in Lookout Mountain, Tennessee. And the person who led the conference was Barry St. Clair. And it was a huge conference. Hundreds, maybe thousands of teens were present for those 3 days. And Barry was the guy that kind of stood up on stage and preached to all of us and connected to all of us. And I kind of looked at him as like a little demigod. Like, there's no way I could ever talk to that man. And except my youth pastor knew I was wrestling with this. And he also knew that Barry had gone to seminary with my dad. And so he set up a meeting, and I had 1 hour with Barry, and I told him what was going on in my soul, and he said, Dave, you don't have to have a dramatic conversion to follow Christ, right? Like, you don't have to get lost in drugs and sex and rock and roll and then, get called. It's just as valid if you've been shaped by the church your whole life. What counts is following Jesus, not how dramatic your conversion is. I said, yeah. He says, the same thing with the call. A slow bend, a slow leading of God is just as valid and powerful as a dramatic U-turn. That's all he said to me. But he was the voice of Eli, cutting through the noise and confusion and just telling me, look, just say, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. That's all you got to do. We all need Eli's to help us hear the voice of God. Because God is speaking. God is calling. God has a mission. You know, like in the Blues Brothers, we're on a mission from God. God has a mission to restore and to redeem all of creation. But the crazy thing is that God's method of executing that mission is through us. Leonard Sweet puts it this way. He says, without God, we can't. But without us, God won't. Or to use the words of Jesus, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. He is waiting for laborers to join him in the work of restoring creation. One last thing about this story of Samuel. I've said it, I don't know how many times before, God does speak. But you can't preach about Samuel and not also recognize the opposite, that God also hears. And the reason I say you have to recognize that is because that's actually what Samuel's name means. You see, his mother Hannah was barren for years and years and years. And she prayed every year at the temple where Eli served, you know, hysterical prayers, asking for God to give her a child. And one day Eli heard her prayers and observed her, and he thought she was crazy and drunk, but she actually said, no, my heart is just broken. And he said, well, then the Lord has heard your prayers and you'll have a son. And when she had that child, she named him Samuel, which meant God has heard. And this is the point, is that God's call always comes out of God hearing. When God called Moses, the call was, I have seen my people suffering in Egypt. I have heard their cries, and I am concerned about their suffering, so I'm choosing you to go. Even when God called Samuel, it's because God saw the people of Israel and heard their cries for a leader, and he was about to do something to make their ears tingle, the Bible says. And so he called Samuel to be part of that work. So maybe this morning, if you're wrestling with your call, not sure where your purpose or your vocation lies, maybe a starting point is just to realize that God hears. God knows. And just as my dad brought that forward to the altar one morning and received a call in response, you might receive your call just when you realize that God hears. Because he calls us to be answers to one another's prayers. And it may not be as dramatically as an audible voice. It might be God putting an Eli or God putting a Hannah in your life, or God asking you to be an Eli or a Hannah in someone else's life. Mother Teresa was once asked about her prayer life. What do you pray for? What do you ask God? And she said to the person who asked the question, No, I don't speak. I just listen. To which the person asked the obvious question, well, oh, you just listen. So what does God say? She said, well, God doesn't speak either. God just listens too. And maybe if we get in a place where we, like Samuel, say, speak, Lord, your servant listens. And we also are aware of God listening to us. And then we enter into that place and listen, not just to God, but to the needs of the world and to the people around us. It's out of that where our calling comes, where we're called to be the hands and the feet and the ears of Christ. Amen.